Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show, taped before a live audience at the Manchester Elementary Middle School in Manchester, Vermont, in partnership with the Northshire Bookstore. This mighty sold-out crowd of more than 700 have gathered to hear from our very special guest. Journalist Rachel Maddow has hosted her own radio and TV shows for the better part of the last 10 years, going from local radio to Air America to MSNBC, where she has hosted The Rachel Maddow Show since 2008. It is now the most popular show on the network. She has just written a new book in which she argues that America's national defense has become disconnected from public oversight. Drift, the unmooring of American military power, traces how U.S. national intelligence agencies have taken over duties that were once assigned to the military, and how this shift has increased the public disconnect from the consequences of war. It is a great pleasure to welcome Rachel Maddow to The Book Show.
Oh, hello. There's a lot of you here. I can see all of you. It's terrifying.
For 90% of the people in this crowd, you are our patron saint. I was listening to you on Howard Stern the other day. No, it's okay. You can admit it. It's fine. And he was commenting about how David Letterman was flirting with you on the air. And you had one of the best comments that I've ever heard, which was, isn't having people on our collective radio and TV shows always a form of flirting?
It has implied flattery in it. You deserve to be here on my thing.
To have you on my thing is a wonderful achievement in my broadcasting career. And I can't thank you enough for that.
And that had better entendre than anything that happened on Howard. That was astonishing. Actually, that was just illegal to say in Vermont.
The name of the book is Drift. We have a copy here. And you have self-described how vague that title is. It's a very vague title.
Yeah.
On purpose.
I think the publisher was worried that people were going to think it was just a very bad novel. I was insisting. I've never written a book before. I don't think I'll ever write a book again. But I was convinced that not having a subtitle, having no explanation whatsoever, would be the way to sell this book. And I think that the people who know more about books rightfully talked me into putting the subtitle on it to give it a little bit of explanatory heft. But the idea behind calling it Drift was that I did not want anybody to lose sight of these things that I'm documenting in the book, this change I think we've gone through. I don't want you to think it was a conspiracy, because I don't think it was a conspiracy. I don't think it was a deliberate thing that somebody set out to change the country in the way that I say I'm so worried about in the book. I don't think it was on purpose. I think it just sort of happened. We drifted into it.
The other thing that you make the point is that I think you're 5 years younger than I am, but we lived through this pretty much. We saw this. And you start from LBJ, really, and bring us to our current day. This is not something that has been lurking in the shadows for centuries. This is really something that we've seen over the past few decades.
Yeah, and I got the idea to write the book, or I felt like I needed to write the book, in the post-9/11 era. I started feeling there was something going on that I wanted to try to explain 4 or 5 years ago when I first started thinking about this. And what I realized I was frustrated about was that so many people who were on the left and on the right, and people who don't have politics at all, so many people who were upset about what happened in national security policy after 9/11 think that it was a post-9/11 problem. And we definitely made some decisions that I think are spurious after 9/11, but I think the roots of us feeling like national security policy makes itself and that the military goes and fights our wars instead of the country going to war, I think the roots of those things, they predated 9/11. We had changed enough in the era after Vietnam that by the time 9/11 happened, we didn't feel like we had very much choice about whether we were going to go to war. We were going to go to war if the president wanted to, and that was essentially it. So there isn't actually very much in the book about George W. Bush. There is stuff in the book about Dick Cheney, but less about him as vice president and more about his time in Congress and his time as Secretary of Defense.
Because if there is a looming character from the 70s to today, it is Dick Cheney.
I really want to interview him.
The book is dedicated to him.
The book is dedicated to Dick Cheney in the hopes that that will make him want to talk to me. I don't think it will.
Good luck with that.
Dick Cheney, what can I offer you? This book. I give you this book. It is for you, sir.
A week ago, maybe a heart.
Yeah, but then I wouldn't be here to talk to him. You know, the New York Daily News did a little tiny, like, I think it was in their gossip column about the fact that I had dedicated the book to Dick Cheney. And I've always said he's my white whale. He is the one person who I want to interview. I will take any member of the Cheney family. It doesn't even have to be him. They wrote a gossip column squib about it. And the last line of the little paragraph they wrote was, "We hope he will have a change of heart." I could not
wow.
believe it. Oh, please tell me you meant that. That was on purpose. That was astonishing. Yeah, but he has a starring role in this. I think when the Iran-Contra scandal happened, which we've kind of forgotten about, we remember Reagan as a saint now, but at the time of the Reagan presidency, and especially in the second term of the Reagan presidency, he not only was not thought of as a saint, but Iran-Contra really loomed largest in many ways over his legacy. And, you know, the deficit and the way that he dealt with the Cold War and Grenada and some other things I write about. But Iran-Contra was a huge deal. And the defense that the Reagan administration cooked up to kind of save Reagan's butt from the Iran-Contra scandal fallout was that they said, we realize that the president decided to break the law, to overtly and on purpose evade something that Congress passed a law saying he could not do. Selling arms to Iran, using the proceeds to fund the Contras. Congress knew he wanted to do it, told him he couldn't, and he went and did it anyway. But we've decided after the fact that he shouldn't get in trouble for it because, what could we come up with? What? Because we believe that if the president wants to do something about national security, he can do it, and there's nothing that can constrain him. It was an ad hoc, radical, after the fact, cooked up defense trying to save Reagan. I don't think they thought of it in advance. I think they came up with it as a defense when they needed to. And when Reagan got in trouble and Congress investigated Iran-Contra, there was this backbench Wyoming Republican congressman who filed a minority dissenting view to what Congress found. And he said, actually, I kind of agree with the Reagan administration. There was no crime here. A president can do anything he or she wants when it comes to national security. Nothing constrains a president as long as he says he's acting in the nation's national security interest. And that was a cockamamie, crazy, marginal thing from some backbench, unimportant Wyoming Republican congressman until he became White House Chief of Staff and Secretary of Defense and then the most powerful vice president in history. So I want to ask him about that.
We want you to ask him
Thank you.
About that. And the other thing, while he is there saying, yes, this is a good thing, you note in the book that during Iran-Contra, a Georgia congressman by the name of Newt Gingrich was saying, well, this is bad.
This Reagan guy. Yeah,
yeah,
we didn't understand what he was like. Yeah. I
love
Newt Gingrich. I love everything about Newt Gingrich. But Newt Gingrich, one of the things
really?
That he's... One of the things that's been awesome for Newt Gingrich about his 2012 in politics is that he's been selling a lot of DVDs. So he may not be collecting any delegates toward the nominating convention. But he and Calista have been selling books and DVDs. And we love people who sell books. It's great. But one of his vote for me, also buy my DVD offers is his like Reagan hagiography about and how he's trying to say not only was Reagan a saint, but I, Newt Gingrich, facilitated the sainthood of Ronald Reagan. He couldn't have done it without me, essentially. And in Iran-Contra, you look at what he was saying. He was totally throwing Reagan under the bus, which is probably what Reagan deserved to be, given what he did. But Newt Gingrich was not exactly his was not exactly his wingman at the time.
I would just want to read what you write in the book, because the book is beautifully written.
Oh, thank you.
Here's the end of the chapter, Stupid Regulations. When Ronald Reagan extricated himself from the Iran-Contra scandal by cutting one of those crucial mooring lines, without considered forethought or a specific course headings in mind, it set the country adrift and heading into a dangerous tide. So even though we had all the stuff, we had Vietnam, we had a bit of a self-correction, right? Where we tried to figure out what the hell we did and to make sure that that never happened again, and then we went right back into it again.
Yeah, and that process, that arc, which has happened essentially sort of over the course of my lifetime, I was born in right at the end of the Vietnam War in 1973, that we had a national correction after Vietnam because of everything we know about Vietnam and because of the way that we felt we had gone wrong as a country there. And so there was all sorts of interesting changes made. Congress asserted its constitutional prerogative that they're supposed to be the ones who make decisions about war with the War Powers Act. Not only that piece of legislation, but also just their newfound ownership of war and peace was manifest in all sorts of interesting ways. Gerald Ford tried to make us go back to Vietnam. And Congress, Democrats and Republicans in Congress, used appropriations to say, no, you cannot do it. We are Congress and we are not allowing you to do it. The president wanted to go back into Vietnam. He kept saying, I don't want it to be a massive thing anymore, but we do need to put a few more troops. And Congress said, no. They confronted him in a way that horrified him as the president, but which was sort of the way that Congress was supposed to use its power over those sorts of things. We also had one really interesting thing that happened within the military, which is that a general named Creighton Abrams, who Nixon really hated, Creighton Abrams was Secretary of the Army at the end of the Vietnam War. He oversaw the demobilization at the end of Vietnam, and he instituted something called the Total Force Doctrine, which everybody calls the Abrams Doctrine. And it said, if you want to have a big war, you have to use the Guard and Reserves. We're going to put operational functionality in the Guard and Reserves so that you can't just have the regular Army go and leave the Guard and Reserves at home the way we did in Vietnam. The Guard and Reserves mostly were not called up for Vietnam, right? There was a draft, but the Guard and Reserves were left. And the reason that LBJ wanted to use the draft instead of the Guard and Reserves is because he felt like the children, the sons of a lot of influential people had gotten themselves into the Guard and Reserves in order to avoid going. So you didn't want to upset those influential people. You didn't want to get calls from well-connected constituents. Instead, you'd use the draft and hope that nobody noticed. People noticed. But they got rid of the draft. They reorganized the Guard and Reserve so that they would be absolutely integral to the way that we had to fight wars. And the idea that Abrams had was that he was worried about the damage that had been done to the military. He loved the Army. But he also did not want the country to ever be able to have a big war again without dislocating American civilian lives at the same time, so that we would feel like a country that went to war. And that was... had very far-reaching consequences. The U.S. military is the largest organization in the world. So even small policy changes can have a really, really big effect on our big country and on millions of people within it. So there were these changes that were made, all of which were to sort of kind of set us up to the way we used to be, the way that I think the Constitution intended us to be around war and peace. And then over the course of sort of Reagan presidency and thereafter, we chipped away at all of those things. And that's, I think, how we got where we are now.
In fact, in the book, you have a to-do list of things that we, at the end of the book, of what we can actually do to try to get out of this. And one of the things that you call for is that our Guard and Reserves need to be the Guard and Reserves again, because these are our men and women, as you write, who are now... This is 24/7 for year after year after year, and it was never intended to be that way.
The relationship of the Guard and Reserves as a bridge between civilian life and military life is an important and delicate thing in our country. And since 9/11, we've been waging the longest war in American history, and simultaneously another 8.5 year long war in Iraq, plus all of the other military engagements that we know less about and that are less debated. And so we've had less than 1% of the country waging these massive and massively long wars in our name, and they're dealing with, you know, 3, 4, 5 more combat deployments. Military families' lives since 9/11 have been really, really, really different than the average American civilian family's lives. And one of the things that happened in the post 9/11 era is that the Garden Reserves started getting called up so often that a lot of us in civilian life can't even tell the difference between guardsmen and reservists and active duty military, because it's become almost the same type of life. It's not supposed to be that. It's not supposed to be that the Garden Reserves never get called up, and it's not supposed to be that they are constantly called up. If you are in the Garden Reserves, you are supposed to have a mostly civilian life, and you are called up when your country needs you, and then you go back to civilian life. And you stay trained, and you stay equipped, and you get the benefits that go along with that, but you are supposed to be rooted in civilian life, and so therefore we civilians are supposed to notice when you're not there. It has political consequences as well as strategic consequences. And this is one of the things I think it's hard to, for some reason it doesn't have very much political resonance. But every time I talk about it in public, I get a lot of this. Because we all know guardsmen and reservists in our families, in our communities, in our friends, and we know that that life is maybe not what was promised.
You talk in the book a lot about, and one of the things that you attribute to how we got where we are is simply secrecy. And what comes through in the book, loud and clear, from LBJ to today, and this is what frightens me, is that it seems as though a president can do whatever the hell they want to do.
And, you know, I am not a pacifist. I am not a person who is against all war all the time. And I have respect for people who have a pacifist philosophy or belief system. But that's not where I come from. And actually, the book isn't about the merits of any particular war. I do have sympathy for the idea that the president ought to have some amount of individual authority to defend the country. I mean, the way that the founders talked about it was to do things like repel invasion, right? So there ought to be some way to act in a nimble way, using force when need be. But it ought to be a limited thing. Secrecy is, I'm sure, tempting for people who have power, because it's a way of avoiding accountability. If nobody knows you're doing it, you can't be asked about it, so you don't have to explain it. And also, if it goes poorly, it's a way of avoiding accountability. And if you give people the power to declare anything secret that they need to declare secret, yeah, some of it will be secret with good operational reasons and thinking behind it, and some of it will be wimping out. Some of it will be political cowardice.
So whether it's Reagan in Grenada, or Bush 1 in Iraq, or Clinton in Bosnia, or the situation that we're in now, what is the motivation? What is the motivation for the president to say, because you outlined in here, and by the way, this book is beautifully, I mean, not only do you write beautifully, but you edit, you take pieces of testimony and articles and verbatim and put them in, and just, which I assume is a real pain in the ass. Actually.
Yes.
I would think that would be.
Yeah, like you see this?
Yeah. But it so adds to the point. But you, time and time again throughout the book, you hear a voice of reason. And it can come from the strangest place, of whether it's William F. Buckley or John Wayne.
Seriously,
John Wayne, yeah. Who had a great quote. And people, of course, of the administration who come in and say, can't we diplomatically try to figure out how to avoid going to war? So what is the getting the backup to say, to just dismiss that, to shut the door, to allow it to be said, but then not pay any attention to it?
You know, I think that looking at the evidence that I lay out in the book, I think different people are going to come to different conclusions about it. Personally, what I feel like is that people make decisions based on what they want to get done in the short run. It is almost always, I think, here motivated by what they think is right for the country. But there's some hassle involved. There's something annoying stopping them from doing something that they think is good for the country. And so, for example, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan's policies in Central America and South America are things that I absolutely disagree with. And if you were Ronald Reagan's constituent when he was president, you also disagreed with him on that. He could not convince the country to do what he wanted to do in Central America. Even when he had sky-high approval ratings, even when he was able to convince the country of lots of other things, including lots of other controversial national security things, he could not get people to think his way about Nicaragua. And still, he was absolutely convinced of what he needed to do in Nicaragua. So one barrier that he had was Congress passing a law saying, we know what you want to do in Nicaragua, that would be illegal. So he came up with a way around that, which was to act illegally and in secret and come up with what all he did, doing all the stuff that ended up causing the Iran-Contra scandal when it came out. Then there was the problem of not persuading the public. Well, secrecy helps there too. Secrecy not only helps you not get caught, it lets you not explain yourself. It saves you the trouble of winning the argument. Secrecy is, I think, secrecy is one of those things that's very hard to root out in the national security field, even more than the other places the government likes to use it, just because they can always say, well, we can't let you know because then the bad guys will know, right? So it's hard, but that's the way they do it. The other barriers that that presidents have to doing things they want to do are other forms of political constraint that stop them from using the U.S. military even when they want to use force. They say let's say you want to train the Croatians. Let's say you want to arm the Croatians. Let's say our involvement with NATO and and what Congress thinks about it means that we can't use U.S. military to do that. Well, Bill Clinton found a company called MPRI, which would do it for profit. These are all ways that we have come up with to make presidents able to pursue national security aims without the things that were supposed to constrain them from doing it in a way that would hurt the country, or that would divorce what our military did from our control over it as citizens who get to participate in a democratic government. It was all about just accommodating whatever the latest local hassle was. And the little voices of reason that you can hear throughout the book, I think, are mostly people who are thinking with foresight, or at least thinking, there's probably a reason we're not supposed to be able to do this. If it's so stupid for Congress, a committee of 500-something people to be deciding on war and peace, if that's such a stupid thing to do for national security, then why did the founders do it that way? Why did they make it a core American value that the powers of war and peace would be vested with studied care in the legislature and not in the executive? They did that on purpose. Should we wonder, should we think about what that's for before we throw it away? Shut up, I need to get to Nicaragua. I think it's long-sightedness versus short-sightedness. I don't think either one of those is a word. But I do think that we can get back to the way it was supposed to be, because I don't think it's been that long since we've been off course. On the executive power thing, no matter what you think about the current president, whether you are a fan or not, I don't think any president could be counted on to give away power that is accrued to the executive. I think a president who gets inherited even radically extra-constitutional power is not going to give away that power willingly. Once they've got it, they feel like they're in office, they know what the country's best interests are, and they're going to use that power for the country's best interests. Nobody gives away power. Power has to be taken by somebody else. And in this case, it needs to be taken by Congress.
The name of the book is Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power, and it is out from Crown. It has been such a thrill to have you on the show. It really has been an absolute delight.
Oh, thank you.
Rachel Maddow's new book is Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power. It is published by Crown. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. This has been a special off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show. Many thanks to the entire staff and crew of the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester, Yay! Vermont. Please go to www.northshire.com for more information. Kudos to the support team here at Manchester Elementary Middle School. A super thank you to our producer, Sarah LeDuc, who is here producing our program today. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
I'm living in that 21st century, doing something mean to it. Do it better than anybody you ever seen do it. Screams from the haters, got a nice ring to it. I guess every superhero need his theme music. No one man should have all that power. The clock's ticking, I just count the hours. Stop tripping, I'm tripping off the power. The system broken, the school's closed, the prison's open. We ain't got nothing to lose, everybody. We